Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. Frank, how you doing?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. I am still here in Sweden on holiday.
I should say congratulations to you. You've just celebrated 30 years of blissful marriage. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yesterday was our anniversary, and we went out for dinner last night at the place where we had our wedding reception in 1989.
And we are celebrating our 100th anniversary episode, our 100th episode, which is a anniversary of a different kind, probably not as momentous, but, worthy of some kind
David,
of celebration.
100 episodes with you is exactly like 30 years of my
– Well, you know, there are lots of marriages that last 30 years, lots of podcasts that don't last for 100 episodes. I don't know what the divorce rate is on podcasts, but So one of the things we'd like to do today is we'd like to sort of reflect on the past 100 episodes and take some listener feedback. We have feedback. We got a bunch of mail questions from listeners we'd like to answer. And then we'd like to sort of talk a little bit about the future of the podcast.
Okay.
So Frank, 100 episodes ago, back when we sort of planned this whole thing, what has surprised you in the process of doing these past 100 episodes?
Well, the most pleasant surprise, I think, is the fact that anybody listens to it at all, and that we have a lot of quite loyal listeners who get in touch via email and on social media, and we occasionally get to meet them, which is
exactly
great, and they're all over the world. I mean, and that's been really, really gratifying, and I think that we've developed a bit of a small little community around our podcast. I think that's excellent, but that's been the most enjoyable aspect of this and certainly the most pleasant surprise, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, and it should say some of our colleagues listen, which is very sweet. You know,
yes.
We have a few colleagues who say, oh, I heard this or that, and they suggest episode ideas and occasionally appear. And I think that's great too.
Yeah. You'd think they'd be sick of us after working with us all day long. They want to have more of us during their free time, but yes, thank you everybody for listening. It's been really great to meet listeners in person. We've had a couple of live shows where we've had a chance to meet people who listened and had to have drinks with a few listeners and meet people at conferences and all kinds of things. And so it's been really great in that respect. We began the show, right after Trump's election, at this sort of weird inflection point in American history, I'm not quite sure what I expected the next 2 years to look like. It's been a very strange couple of years, but I think the podcast has been a great way for me to sort of process and think about these things that have been happening both in the United States and around the world, and try to put it in some historical context and to talk to you, who usually has more insight into these things than I do. That's been really helpful for me. So thank you, Frank, for helping me make sense of this bizarre world that we're living in now.
My pleasure, David. Although I would, as always, push back at your statement. I don't believe I have more insight than you do, but I've really enjoyed the chat with you.
Yeah. I mean, our original premise for the show was that we'd be having conversations in pubs and doing this. And, we did that for a few episodes, but, it still seems sometimes like we should be drinking heavily while we record these things. Yes. Anyway, so we got a bunch of listener questions. You want to tackle some of those, Frank?
Yeah, let's do it. All right. So it's like, it's exactly like talk radio. So
exactly
we'll take
like
a
talk.
Caller.
Okay. So
who's
well,
on line one, David?
Our first caller is Jasmine.
One of our loyal listeners we got to meet.
Yes. Yes. And she's actually, I think, Jasmine has the question, is Trump Bojo's relationship, Bojo there is Boris Johnson, the new prime minister, is Trump Bojo's relationship a continuation or a break with the idea of a special relationship?
Right. Well, we've talked about – thank you for that, Jasmine. We've talked about the special relationship several times, unsurprisingly. I'm a skeptic about it at some level. But on the other hand, I think when it has been most useful to leaders on both sides of the Atlantic is at moments when those leaders are more or less simpatico with each other, either in terms of their politics or personalities or both. It's most successful when both of those things align. And so I'm thinking, you know, the FDR Churchill relationship during the Second World War, but also Thatcher and Reagan.
Sure.
Were, you know, got along well personally, and as well as their politics aligned. Thatcher and Reagan, and Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. It's less successful when those leaders either don't have that personal connection or they're kind of ideologically pulled in opposite directions. You know, it wasn't that close and it wasn't that successful between Barack Obama and David Cameron, for example. That being said, therefore, I think paradoxically, although both men are quite unpopular and polarizing figures in their own politics and in their own countries, Donald Trump and Boris Johnson do have a lot in common in terms of their politics and their political message and their style. I think Boris Johnson's probably more clever than Donald Trump, and he's certainly more adept in his use of language. But there are some similarities in the way they conduct themselves. And I think, as a result, the special relationship – I don't think this marks kind of the end of the special relationship so much as a new phase. What will be interesting, I guess, is – both men are relatively unpopular with their own electorates, and I'm not sure hugging each other close will necessarily help them with their domestic audiences or with their audiences in the other country. My sense is that Boris is, if he's thought about it all in the United States, he's probably reasonably well liked because he's seen as a kind of amiable clown. And a kind of articulate alternative to Trump, but I don't know how long that will last. And Trump, as we both know, is, let's just say, not terribly popular in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
What do you think? What do you think?
Well, so you know, just going on the comparison of the two men, you know, they're actually both born in New York City. You know, they both see themselves as being sort of separate and above the sort of formal traditional political parties that they are a part of. You know, they don't necessarily play by the sort of well-defined rules of how politics is supposed to work. They both speak off the cuff more often than not.
More often than they should.
Well, yeah, that's without, yes. And I think they're both facing a very divided political landscape in their own countries, to put it mildly. You know, the special relationship, though, is a relatively, you know, new phenomenon in some ways. It's only been, you know, in the since the 1930s, really. Is this, you know, can you talk about this sort of special relationship that starts with, you know, Churchill FDR relationship going forward? You know, the United States and Great Britain were at various times, you know, enemies or you know, rivals throughout the 19th century. You know, so they haven't always seen eye to eye. It's not been a relationship that has been a amicable one for much of its history. I mean, the other thing I like to think about is, you know, when people think about the special relationship and when American and British diplomats talk about it, they're talking not only about the relationship between the head of state in the two countries, but also between the sort of cultural affinities between the two countries. And I think that that part of it is still very healthy, right? I think that the United States and the UK are largely part of a common sort of cultural vocabulary. Lots of British people visit the United States. Lots of Americans visit the UK.
Well, we live in each other's countries as well, and we're married to each other and so on. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and the fact that, you know, Boris was born
I don't think that matters.
Well, no, but the fact that he was born in New York City and the fact that Donald's mother was born in the UK, you know, sort of speaks to that kind of part of a transatlantic relationship, you know, those aren't disqualifying in some ways. So I don't, you know, I think they have a very interesting, weird personal relationship. I think both men do function very much in terms of the politics of the personal, much more so than the politics of policy alliances or clear, traditional political factions. They also, both men, I think the one thing they have in common is they both think they're the smartest person in the room.
Yes, and in most cases, that's not true.
Depends how many people are in the room. Yes.
I suppose if they're both in the room, that's an interesting discussion. But
yes.
I mean, I agree with you on the cultural level. I mean, the special relationship, as so-called, you're right, is born of the kind of 1940s, and it continues during the Cold War. And to some extent, it describes and defines the security relationship between the U.S. and U.K., which remains very, very strong, regardless of who the leaders are on either side of the Atlantic. But it's stronger still, at least at the public level, when those leaders, as I suggested before, are kind of aligned either personally or politically. I think you're absolutely right that of far greater significance are the kind of cultural affinities between the two places and the personal connections between them. And that's been true even in times of kind of diplomatic tension between the two nation states. I mean, Dickens's American Notes, which excoriate the United States and Americans, in large part were driven by the fact that Dickens was outraged by the fact that his work was being pirated and published in the United States, and it was pirated and published in the United States because there was such a market for it in the United States in the 1840s and 50s. And so those kind of cultural links and Dickens, the serializations of Dickens and Anthony Trollope and other Victorian writers is that's the equivalent of a Netflix series now, and those cultural links are long standing, very deep, and are largely immune from whatever the international situation is. It will be interesting to see as the U.S. changes demographically, whether that remains the case, though, whether that cultural affinity, which is very much grounded in, among other things, language, remains as strong. But, I think the special relationship, I hate that term personally, but I think it will outlast both Trump and Boris. But I think under Trump and Boris, which was Jazz's original question, I think it will probably appear to strengthen, much to the horror of, I think, voters in both countries.
Yes,
not because they don't like each other, on the contrary, but because they don't like those leaders.
Yes, and neither man is doing very well in the popularity polls. Right.
No.
All right, so our next question.
Who's our next caller, David?
Ewan Sinclair. And I'll just read the – I know you guys aren't supposed to deal with what-ifs, but what if Lincoln hadn't been shot at Ford's Theater? How would Reconstruction have played out?
Excellent question. And, I mean, we don't usually do counterfactuals, although counterfactuals are fun. So this
why don't we do counter – I guess part of the question is why don't we do counterfactuals? Why don't – I mean, not only sort of we as a show, but why don't historians – play with counterfactuals too much?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think we don't, because it very quickly takes us into the realm of the counterfactual very much quickly becomes almost fiction or science fiction, because you don't. It depends on how you want to play it out. And so I think in the Lincoln cases we'll address in a minute, I think that's I like the way Ewan framed that, because it's a very specific question and it applies to Reconstruction. And I'm going to hand things over to you on that. But it's trickier with you very quickly get yourself into the weeds talking about counterfactuals, although it's often fun. I mean, I'm going to get – after we talk about this one, perhaps I'll give you another one that's a favorite of mine, which is, okay, what if the British win the American War of Independence?
Okay.
And that's kind of a big one, but then you quickly, spin out of control. But anyway, let's and we're supposed to stay in the realm of fact, and I'm using air quotes now.
Sure.
So David, if Lincoln is not assassinated in April of 1865, what does Reconstruction look like?
My real answer is, who the hell knows. But
that's the other reason we don't do counterfactuals.
Well, I mean, before I sort of give my answer to this, my thinking on counterfactuals is that in some ways all historical thinking plays with some kind of counterfactual. I mean, we play with the idea when we write and when we teach that the way things unfolded isn't necessarily the way things had to have unfolded. Things, people made choices, events had consequences that had other consequences and ramifications, but that it was all really, really complicated, right? And so, you know, there's not a sort of, we're not dealing with a sort of Calvinist model of how history works where everything is predetermined beforehand. That, you know, things do unfold, but they don't unfold in a way that is sort of laid out. So, I mean, the counterfactuals are sort of built into that, the idea that, you know, the past is not, you know, inevitable in some ways.
Or we subscribe to sort of macro historical, you know, interpretations, and we're looking at big factors like industrialization, for example, and individuals aren't that important in those
To be sure.
One takes that approach. Yeah. Anyway, carry on. So Lincoln is not shot, David.
Lincoln is not shot. Well, so that's really tricky because Lincoln's views on lots of questions are evolving throughout the Civil War, you know, and so his questions, particularly about his thoughts on African-American citizenship and freedom and what freedom would look like and what it would mean, you know, they aren't the same, you know, in 1860 when he's running for president. They aren't the same in 1861 when he takes office, you know, and they're not the same, you know, in 1865 when he dies. And so he's evolving and changing over time, you know, with regards to questions about African-Americans voting. He initially says he's against it. Then later on, in large part because of African-American service in the Union Army, he says near the end of his life, actually very much at the end of his life, actually, I think they should, some of them should be allowed to vote. And so it's reasonable to suspect then that Lincoln's views would have also changed had he lived past April of 1865. And I think that's going to affect what kind of what Reconstruction is going to look like. And, you know, I think one of the things you have to compare in thinking about what Reconstruction would have looked like is both what Lincoln would have done had he lived versus what Andrew Johnson did do when he took over after Lincoln's assassination. And there's some big differences between the two men. You know, Lincoln was the head of the Republican Party with the Republican Congress. Johnson was a Democrat who had was then having to deal with the Republican Congress. Johnson was a white Southerner who believed very firmly in white supremacy. Lincoln, you know, was racially much more progressive than Johnson was. And thought black freedom was an important consequence of the war, much more so than Johnson did. So I think a couple of things would have happened. You wouldn't have had the huge fight with Congress, or you've had a different fight with Congress over who was in charge during Reconstruction. Much of the story of Reconstruction is this fight over who was in charge, whether it's the president or Congress. I think that would have played out very differently, in part because Lincoln was a much more skilled politician than Johnson was. I think you would have had this question about black freedom been much more at the center of the story from the very beginning, in at least in the debates in Washington, than it was with Johnson in the summer of 1865. But that being said, it gets really messy very quickly, because part of the reason why Congress becomes so galvanized in 1865, and then especially in 1866, is in response to Johnson's stubbornness. You know, part of the reason why they passed the 14th Amendment and what have you, and the Military Reconstruction Act and override presidential vetoes and eventually impeach him is because Johnson was a very stubborn president, and that made Congress respond to that. And so, you know, would we have had a 14th and 15th Amendment had Lincoln not been assassinated? That's a difficult question to answer, which I guess sort of speaks to the difficulty of doing these kind of counterfactuals, because ultimately you could spin out four or five or 1,000 different alternate histories, all of which are equally plausible, all of which are, you know, seem to be supported by the facts.
I agree. I mean, one could say that I think there are two things that are kind of clear. One is Lincoln was just a much more adroit and skillful politician than Johnson.
Yes.
And he also seemed at least more committed to the cause, however defined, and you've eloquently talked about his evolution, but would certainly be, if there's a spectrum on the civil rights question, the post-emancipation civil rights question, he's also more open to civil rights and more supportive of civil rights than Johnson. I mean, the bar is not very high on that one, but and those two things being true, it seems that Reconstruction couldn't have been worse.
Well, but you could imagine a situation in which, you know, Johnson gave a number of pardons to prominent former Confederates, and he sort of handed them out like candy.
Right.
And you could imagine Lincoln not doing that. But then you could imagine Southerners or white Southerners responding to that by restarting the Civil War potentially. Right. You can, there's all kinds of alternative or engage in an even more sort of terrorist violence than they did. And they engaged in a lot in what actually happened. At a certain point, I sort of throw up my hands and say, I have no idea what the hell's going to happen. I mean, it's a fun parlor game, but it's hard to say. So for you, I guess your favorite one is equally, you know, anything could happen. What happens if the British win the revolution, or if the revolution doesn't happen, or some other kind of variable there?
Well, we don't remember the founders, the so-called founding fathers, as an assembly of demigods, as Jefferson called them, for one thing. And we don't have a whole cult of the founders, but that's not really what's interesting. If the British win the War of Independence, which is an entirely plausible scenario,
Just make sure I understand the scenario. So the Continental Congress declares independence, 4th of July, the whole thing. They have the war and they just lose the war.
Yes.
Is that the scenario? Okay.
Yes, that's the scenario. That's the scenario. So let's suppose the British win the war.
Okay.
I think a number of things might, again, we're speculating here, or I'm speculating, but a number of things might follow. So one way, and I do play this out with students sometimes, because you can, it's one of the discussions is how radical was the American Revolution, and you can look at the impact on society and social change. You can look at the major groups, right? So in terms of common white men who are empowered as a result of the American Revolution, that is a consequence of the revolution, I think. These are, and that probably wouldn't have happened as quickly in North America, but it likely would have happened. Because one thing, if there's one thing we saw in the British Empire, if we look at the history of the British Empire during the 19th century, is efforts are made, partially as a consequence of American independence, it should be said, but to empower white settlers, at least locally. We see this in Canada. We see it in Australia. We see it in New Zealand. So I think white men in North America still would have acquired a degree of autonomy over time, perhaps not as quickly. If one looks at the situation for indigenous peoples, if you look at Native Americans, it's hard to see the scenario being remaining within the British Empire being a worse outcome than American independence. Because one thing the creation of the independent United States did was create a government which empowered those white men who wanted Western land and acted in their interest to displace Native peoples pretty efficiently. And I'm not saying that wouldn't have happened if all that territory had remained within the British Empire, because I think the demography would be the same. You'd have a growing white population that wanted land. And I think that would likely still have happened, but it couldn't have been worse. From the perspective of enslaved people, I think that the counterfactual is really interesting and gets complicated, in the sense that the traditional argument is, and Simon Schaum has made this, and a lot of British students make this, it would have been better for enslaved people if the colonies had lost the War of Independence, because they would have been freed in the 1830s when slavery was abolished in the British Empire. I'm not so sure that's the case. counterfactuals go in different directions. I think if the so-called slave interest, if that southern slaveholding class that becomes very wealthy and very powerful in the early 19th century with the introduction of cotton agriculture across the Southwest, across the South and Southwest of the United of the new United States, if they remain within the British Empire, I'm not so sure that slavery is abolished within that empire, because there'd be a very strong slave interest, not in Congress, but in Parliament, conceivably. Yeah. And so I'm not sure Britain abolishes slavery. I don't think that necessarily follows. Quite the contrary. I think Britain doesn't abolish slavery, and maybe you end up with a civil war within the British Empire over slavery in the mid-19th century. So I'm not sure from the perspective of slavery that things are necessarily better. They could be worse. And then finally, from the perspective of women, I think it's very, very interesting, because the traditional argument is the American Revolution creates – the Republican ideology at the heart of the revolution both constrains women at home but also provides a rhetoric and
– the whole Republican motherhood thesis.
Republican motherhood and – yeah, so and so on. Well, but if you look at the extension or the time frame in which women on both sides of the Atlantic win the right to vote, for example, or a partial right to vote because it's circumscribed by race in the United States – American independence doesn't make a difference, arguably. I mean, women win the partial right to vote in Britain right after the during and right after the First World War, and that's what happens in the United States too. Now, I'm only using politics as a crude measure here. So I think the counterfactual is, you know, there's a sort of neo-loyalist fantasy whereby North America becomes one greater Canada, and everybody thinks that's great, because who wouldn't want a greater Canada? But the other is, I'm not so sure that's the case. I think some of the things that we associate with an independent United States would be associated with this larger North American British Empire. That is, displacement of native peoples, the spread of slavery, and so on. So I'm not so sure. It's a fun counterfactual, but as with the Lincoln one, the further you get from the beginning point of your counterfactual, the crazier it gets.
Yeah, this conversation reminds me, there was an article in the Journal of American History, I want to say it's from, you know, a dozen years ago or so, maybe longer, you know, in which a historian sort of posited what would have happened if in 1844, if Henry Clay had won the election instead of James K. Polk, and what consequence would that have happened for all kinds of things. And he sort of lays out the scenario in which Clay wins and what effect that has on the Mexican War and et cetera and what have you. And it was an interesting article, and I've assigned it to students before, but ultimately it's, you know, when you boil it down, you counterfactuals are—they don't really teach us very much. They're sort of fun to play around with. They help you think about causality in some ways, but in terms of actual rigorous historical thinking, it's very hard to do that with counterfactuals. And one of the things lots of people pointed out when that article came out, you know, in the early 2000s, was, you know, you could imagine a similar counterfactual in which Al Gore actually wins the 2000 election over George W. Bush. What happens then? You know, does 9/11 happen? Probably. Does the United States go to war with Afghanistan? Probably. Does the United States go with Iraq? Maybe not.
I think probably not. I think that's a really interesting counterfactual.
But then you sort of like. There are limits. There are really profound limits to it, you know. And does then Barack Obama ever get elected, or not? You know, it's very hard to sort of think. The way, you know, the politics and culture and society, the ways in which those things are interwoven, in the ways in which causality isn't sort of a causes B, but in fact, you know, this whole plethora of variables causes a whole, you know, panoply of consequences. You know, that's it's hard to sort of play those things out more than a couple of moves in the future.
Well, that's right. But here's another one for you. What if Mitt Romney wins in 2012? If Mitt Romney wins in 2012, we're probably in the midst of the second Romney term right now, and there's no Donald Trump presidency.
That sounds surprisingly better to me right now than it probably did in 2012.
Yeah, well, agreed.
Obama though beat him pretty handily, so I mean, you got
he
sort of,
did, yeah.
With all these funny counterfactuals, it's always about, you know, trying to create a scenario that's nominally plausible. Otherwise, it just gets silly. Right. On to our next question, and this one is from Connor, who is a HCA graduate. And he says, I suspect I know the answer already, but is there any precedent for something as mad as ASAP Rocky diplomatic incident? And this, for those of you who aren't familiar with this story, this is a rapper, an American rapper, ASAP Rocky, who was arrested in Sweden, I want to say a month ago?
That's about that, yeah, I think yes. So.
After an incident in the street in which he was accused, and there's video of this, of him pushing somebody quite violently and what have you. And he was in jail for, I think, 4 weeks, and the President Trump intervened, or at least tried to intervene on his behalf at the request of Kanye West or something like this.
Yes, and one of the Kardashians, I can't keep them straight.
Probably the one that's married to Kanye West.
Yes.
That would make sense, as much as I keep up with these kinds of things. Right. So you've been in Sweden for part of this. What has been the Swedish read on all of these things?
I think the Swedish read has been bemusement on this, not least as the prime minister pointed out. He has no control over the judiciary, and that's true in most functioning democracies. And so that although Trump called on the prime minister to intervene in this incident, the prime minister said, well, I can't really do that. The implication being he shouldn't really do it as well, which is true. And so I think it's been bemusement and a little bit of a sense, and unsurprisingly in the current climate, of a combination of Trump being both ignorant and also attempting to bully, if not a formal ally, certainly a country with which the United States has close relations. But then there's a sort of a collective shrugging of shoulders as well, as sort of like, well, what do you expect from Trump?
Okay. So is there any historical precedent for this?
Well, I think the answer is no, in the sense of the, you know, a president intervening to get a kind of minor celebrity out of trouble at the behest of other celebrities. So if we take it that literally, I don't think there is a precedent for this. I mean, presidents have occasionally intervened, and sometimes quite, or attempted to intervene, and certainly made statements on behalf of Americans who've been arrested abroad, but in most cases, those are not Americans who've been arrested in countries with whom the United States has good relations and whose legal systems we, that is, the United States, judges to be akin to its own. Hmm. Nobody, for you know, if anything, I think the Swedish government would have more cause to complain if a Swede were arrested in the United States than the other way around. I mean, I don't think there's any kind of concern on behalf of the United States about the quality of the Swedish judiciary or the judicial system. And so that's a little unusual. Where presidents have intervened have been in cases in when Americans have been arrested in what the United States has deemed authoritarian countries. And by no measure is Sweden an authoritarian country.
Yes.
I mean, a good example would be the Amanda Knox trial in Italy several years ago, that murder trial which happened during the Obama administration. And President Obama did not intervene on behalf or attempt to intervene in the Italian judicial system on behalf of Amanda Knox, who was accused and convicted of murder, and then her conviction was eventually overturned. The position of the United States during that trial was that the United States should let the Italian judicial system run its course.
So, I mean, one of the things that does happen when Americans get arrested overseas is, you know, the consular service, whether it's the embassy or the consular, what have you, does make sure that Americans get proper representation and understand the legal system that they're in and have a translator and all that kind of stuff. But that's seven or eight levels down from the President of the United States calling the Prime Minister. It's, You know,
right, and I'm sure Mr. Rocky received that kind of consular support.
Yes.
I'm guessing.
The other sort of interest, you know, is that the element to this is that Trump sent the U.S. hostage negotiator as the representative to deal with this particular issue. You know, and one of the things that Trump has done repeatedly in especially North Korea, but in Iran and in Yemen and in a few other places, is try to free U.S. hostages who are being held by undemocratic governments that have authoritarian judicial systems. But that's not Sweden. So I think the fact that it was, you know, that was the person they tasked with this suggests something about the ways in which Trump views he has this very sort of interpersonal and transactional understanding of how justice systems work. And that sort of ties in with the way in which he's used the pardon power. I guess he sort of assumed that the Swedish prime minister had the power to pardon somebody just the way that he has the power to issue pardons in the United States, and therefore, you know, make sort of personal exceptions for situations for people that he cares about for whatever reason. So, yeah, it was weird. Answer Kyle's question.
And I don't really think there's a precedent for it. But.
All right. But we'll see. We got a question here from a person on Twitter named History Chappie. And the question is, do we ever get sick of whiskey?
Oh, that's an easy one. No.
Yeah, I think the answer is no. we have plenty to choose from here, and we have not yet gotten our whiskey sponsorship. So if you are a distiller in Scotland or in the United States, we're not picky. Who wants to sponsor us?
Don't make us big.
Yeah, but we're available.
He also suggested that we do an episode on prohibition.
Yes, he did. I think that the ways in which the United States relates to consumption, both of alcohol and other things, is worthy of a whole episode. So we'll have to do that at some point when it becomes particularly newsworthy. Are there things about, sort of the part of the subtext in some ways of the question is, what things about the United States do you miss living in Scotland?
I do miss, I think the cultures are broadly similar. We talked about this with respect to the special relationship a few minutes ago. But I think there are certain differences in the way people interact that I miss them when I'm in each country. So I love the way the Scots are, and I love the way there's a sort of friendliness to Scotland that's very different from the friendliness in the United States, but I miss both. So I do miss the ease of interaction in the United States. Mm. When you go out and go somewhere, when you want to, I don't know, go to the bank and conduct your business, your day-to-day business in the United States, just of living, is those interactions are friendlier than they are in the United Kingdom on the whole, I think. And having recently lived in the United States for a few months, that was brought home to me. I like being in a place where my accent doesn't immediately identify me as foreign, because there's a certain baggage that comes with that sometimes. You know, you can relax in a way when you're home, wherever home is and however you define home. And that's not a criticism of Scotland at all. The Edinburgh Festival's on right now, right? And it's great. But I hate being in Edinburgh in August from this perspective, which is the minute I open my mouth, people think I'm a tourist.
Yeah, I got my haircut. I got my haircut yesterday, and the guy said, "Are you here for the festival?" I said, "No, right. I've probably been living here longer than he has." But
yeah, and they talk to you like you're a moron, and there's a sort of. But There's a sort of so I miss that. I miss there are a lot of things I miss. Although I go to the United States a lot, and the benefits of living in Scotland are far outweigh the downsides. What do you miss?
I mean, I think you're right. Some of the sort of customer service stuff in the United States is
It's better.
yes, but you know, I think the supposition is that employees at service places in the United States were supposed to bend over backwards for for customers, whereas I think employees at Scottish institutions, I think have more respect given to them and their time. And I say that as somebody who did work in retail in the United States. You know, if a customer walked into the Starbucks I worked into 2 minutes before we closed, we were still supposed to serve them and let them hang out for an extra half hour if they wanted to hang out, even if I had somewhere to go, right? Whereas I think in Scotland, if you walk in 2 minutes before they're supposed to close, they're like, "We're closing in 2 minutes. You have to leave," because the employees, you know, so there's a different sort of sense there. I've been kicked out of a lot of shops in Edinburgh for, you know, being there right when they closed, which it doesn't happen nearly as much in the United States. The thing I honestly miss the most, and this is stupid, the bottomless cup of coffee. And you're not a coffee drinker, Frank.
I'm not a coffee drinker, so.
But the American diner where you can go and you order a cup of coffee and it's never empty because the waitress comes by every 5 minutes and refills it. I really, really miss that. Because there's some
Okay.
places here who are American diners, but they don't do that. That's a cultural amenity I availed myself of when I'm in the United States. And obviously, the United States is a huge place, and so, you know, different parts of the United States, I have different things to offer. Yeah, we don't have that in Scotland. We also have graham
Okay.
crackers. There are no graham crackers here. I like graham crackers, but I could probably order those if I tried hard enough. Beyond that,
Yeah,
yeah, it's.
curiously, I don't miss the food isn't really an issue because almost every, I mean, graham crackers are an example of something I guess it's hard to find, but most things you can find if you look,
Yeah.
it's not that hard. And
No.
well, I'll tell you this, whenever I'm flying to either place, I always feel like I'm going home and I'm excited,
Yeah,
which is a good feeling, which is a good feeling.
same here. Yeah, it is. I feel equally at home in both places, or equally awkward in both places, as the case may be.
Right.
Right, so we had some other questions which we probably won't have time for, but there, I mean, there were some got some great questions about sort of about reparations, for instance. We may
Well, in
have to
fact,
do a
we want to
whole
do an episode on that, I
episode on
think.
rep. So I think, you know, we don't want to give short shrift to some good questions. So now that we've reached 100 episodes, Frank, what do you want to do with the next 100 episodes?
Interesting. I think a couple of things. We're aware of our challenges when it comes to recording, and to some extent, this is reflects the fact that I've been on the road a lot in the past year, and we want to get on top of recording together and improving our sound quality. I also think we should, much as we love chatting with each other, and we do, I think we need to bring in some new voices. I've enjoyed the episodes when we've interviewed colleagues and friends on various topics, and I think we should do more of that. And again, that will be easier to arrange when I'm, fully back in Edinburgh on a permanent basis. Those are the two things that strike me. And I think we also want to meet more listeners. I mean, I think we need to do more events reaching out and locally and when we're on if and when we're on the road together to meet listeners. So I think we should try to do that. What about you?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking all of the same things. You know, we've been sort of, when we started this thing, we sort of went into it not really knowing exactly what we were doing, and I'm not sure we know what we're doing now. But I think we have a greater idea of sort of what we wanted to do with the show in some ways. And I think, you know, upping our production quality. We've had the world's worst audio engineer for the past 2 years, that being me. And so I'm going to try to actually learn something about how to do this and get some maybe some better equipment and all these kinds of things. But I the many of the episodes I've enjoyed doing the most, or, you know, as much as I love just talking to you, Frank, you know, the ones where we get a guest in, or especially the times where we've had live events and had a, you know, room full of people to talk to, those are in some ways the most fun, because you get all different kinds of opinions and, you know, ways of thinking about the past, and I think, you know, having an audience is a fun thing to do. So well, yeah, we're going to have all kinds of growth and new things coming up for our next 100 episodes.
Indeed, indeed. So to our next 100 episodes, David.
Yes.
To infinity
and beyond. All right. Do you have a last drop for us, Frank?
Well, I do, but it's kind of negative.
Okay, so it's a
strong note to end on, but I think many, many episodes ago, I endorsed the podcast series Dirty John, which was so produced by...
Faithful listeners will remember this is from like episode 30 or something. Yes.
Yep. And it's a really interesting podcast produced by the Los Angeles Times. And it's, I won't go into the details of the story, except to say it's about this kind of grifter who comes in and marries this woman. And it's a complicated story. It's an interesting story. And I thought the podcast was excellent. At the moment, we're watching the Netflix series based on that. And with Connie Britton, who's an actress I really, really like, she's been in a lot of things.
She was in Friday Night Lights and Nashville and stuff. Yeah.
And she's a very good actress. And Eric Bana, the Australian actor. Anyway, it shouldn't be not everything should be a Netflix series. It's very, very disappointing. And I'm stuck. My sister-in-law really likes it, and I've been watching it with her, and she wants to finish. My wife's given up. and it just makes me think that – so I want to endorse the podcast again, which I think is really good. And it's a cautionary tale that not everything should be a Netflix series. It probably would have made a very good movie for 2 hours.
Yeah.
But, you know, an 8-part series, so it's a cautionary tale, and I guess I'm telling you not to watch Dirty John on Netflix, but to listen to the podcast.
Yeah, there aren't that many podcasts that make good movies or television programs.
Well, some, like, you know,
Homecoming worked really well, I thought, but by the way, if anyone from Netflix or Amazon is listening to this and wants to make make a show of the two of us, but that would be pretty awful. So I want to endorse a podcast that may also actually make a good movie or miniseries or something. It's from last year, so I'm a bit late getting to it, but it's still, you know, worth listening to. It's from WBUR in Boston, your local home
public radio station.
Yeah, exactly. It's called Last Scene. And it's the story of the theft of a number of pieces of art at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum that have never been recovered. They haven't figured out what happened to the paintings that were stolen. It was worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars or something. And so it's a 10-part series. I'm about halfway through it, where they're trying to piece together the story not only of the crime that happened, but also trying to figure out, you know, who stole these paintings and where they are now. And so I don't know, I haven't gotten to the end, so I don't know what the end of the story is, if there is an end of the story, or whether it's going to end up like Serial and they're just going to throw up their hands and say, we don't know. Thus far, it's been really, really good. So Last Scene from WBUR.
Excellent. Good.
Great. Well, to our next 100 episodes, Frank.
To our next 100, David. All right.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.